You are listening to Fanfare Tracks.
Because of the following special program, Wonder Woman and the Incredible Hulk will not be presented this evening.
Time to get all your Star Wars news in a single file. This is Making Tracks. Here are your hosts, Mark Newbold and Mark Wolcaster.
It's not true. That's impossible.
You're listening to Making Tracks. This is episode 31. I'm your co-host, Mark Newbold, and joining me today is it's a man who not only has been self-isolating for about 3 weeks, but he's also got, later in the episode, a wonderful story to tell about Lorne Peterson. Mark, how you doing, man?
I'm very well, my friend. How are you?
I'm good. I've got the tickly cough of hay fever just starting up. I'm on the Benadryl. We've got loads to talk about this episode. I mean, we've got absolutely tons to talk about this episode. We're going to talk about Clone Wars. We're going to talk about Mandalorian. We're going to look back at Celebration. We're going to talk about some Hasbro reveals that we put on the site. There's an interview with Lorne Peterson, as I've just mentioned, and your story coming on later. Apart from that, Mark, since the week since we've spoke, has much happened in your life?
No, not a huge amount. This is actually my fourth week of working from home, business as usual. I think everybody's now fairly used to it. They're just trying to kind of not go completely nuts. Karen hasn't actually buried me under the patio yet, so
this time.
I must be doing something okay, or not doing something, I guess, maybe. It is what it is. Luckily, having just finished the Rise of Skywalker expanded novel, I've just received the Art of Rise of Skywalker. So I have some kind of stuff to keep me interested. And of course, there's lots of wonderful articles being posted on Fanfare Tracks.
Yes.
So that keeps, you know, and you've been writing a lot of reviews.
We've had reviews that I've posted on Lightsaber back in, blimey, I think one review we put on recently was from 1999.
Oh, wow.
Which is, like, ridiculous. And I thought, do I change it? Do I try and sort of contemporise it? Nah. Leave it as it was. It's a snapshot of times, a very honest review of when it came out. Putting some of that stuff on. And some more recent reviews. I'm getting through comics, and we'll have, as you just mentioned, Art of Rise of Skywalker. I think we've both got a copy of that, so that'll be turning up fairly soon. And your review of Rise of Skywalker, the extended edition of the novel. Thank you very much for that. So that's going down very well.
That's all right. That was, I think it's my first formal review I think I've ever done for the site, so yeah. Apologies for all the typos and all the grammatical errors you've probably had to edit out and smooth.
That's what I'm here for, man.
It's true, yeah. It's a curse of being an editor.
It's all good, you know all about that. Let's get straight into the flow of this episode. We've had now the great luxury in the UK of catching up with the States with episodes of The Clone Wars. So now we're neck and neck. So finally, everything is as it should be in that regard, certainly with The Clone Wars. We've had two episodes. We've had Dangerous Debt and Together Again. Let's kick off with Dangerous Debt. What did you think of that episode? I thought it was a cracker. Some people called it a filler. I wouldn't agree. I thought it was a really good little episode.
That is an interesting thing to say, because I was sat here, having watched it. Well, they start off in a cell,
yes,
and they end up in the same cell. But actually, okay, so if we look at it from that perspective, not a lot happens. But there's quite a bit to unpack, especially with the relationship and what we find out about Trace and Rafa and how their parents died and stuff. So yeah, it's one of those kind of episodes where I think on the surface you could possibly argue it's a little bit of a filler, but actually there's a lot in there. And I was quite surprised when I was watching it just how much action and just how many different set pieces and stuff fitted in. I think I must have got to about 18 minutes or something and I paused it because I was thinking, is this a double length episode or something, or have I managed to go into the second episode? Because it just seemed to be like long in terms of a lot happening. So
yeah,
I wouldn't call it a filler, I don't think, by any stretch of imagination. And lots of Easter eggs in this episode, I think, or at least references back to stuff in the previous Clone Wars series.
Yeah, I get why people would say filler. I get the logic of that thought process, but only in the sense of what you've just said. They start off in the cell and they end up in the cell, but it felt like more of a character piece.
Yeah.
And there's some gorgeous designs in it. I mean, when they're running around the Pike base, the designs for that was just absolutely fantastic. But it was more, for me, the episode was more about learning how Rafa's mind works as much as anything else. Tracy's a bit of a dreamer, but Rafa's a realist, even if she's a little bit misguided in the way she thinks about things. She's more of a pragmatist. And you know, whereas Rafa's like, oh, let's get a starship and head for the stars and live a wonderful life. And she's a little bit naive. And it all goes back to me, and the way I read it is, they shouldn't be doing this job, really. It's a bit naughty, but we have seen Spice Runners before. Zori, Poe, Han and Chewie, they're not evildoers. They're maybe misguided. They're doing what they can to get out of the hole that they're in.
Yeah, I mean, they are way, way over their heads, I think. I think it's fair to say. And they recognise that near the end of the arc. But you kind of imagine that probably even maybe to a lesser extent, but maybe Han and Chewie were probably, well, as we know, were blatantly just winging it every time they, you know, they got into any kind of situation. So, yeah, it's not something that is unexpected, I guess, really. I mean, and I think sometimes given the colourfulness and sometimes the light-heartedness of some of these episodes, you forget these are hardened criminals that they are dealing with. We're not talking about the guy in that first episode. He's just kind of trying to get his money back. You know, he's kind of small-time, kind of like, you know, big fish in a small pond kind of guy. These are kind of galactic criminals who really don't take any BS, so...
That's a good point. And as you say, you know, they're in over the heads. And there's that sort of slightly, maybe the wrong turn of phrase, but almost like that romantic notion of, you know, Captain Jack living the high life as a pirate on the seas, you know. And you actually watch the films and it's like, Jack's an absolute slime bag and he's a criminal and he'll steal the rings off your fingers if you shook your hand sort of character. But he's charming. So because he's charming, he kind of gets almost like the logic of, it's almost like Ben at the end of Rise of Skywalker. Oh, he's kind of cute, isn't he? You know, so let's let him live. As opposed to if Ben still looked like Kylo at the end of Rise of Skywalker, I don't think as many people would be bothered that he didn't live. It's slightly vacuous, but there's almost a charm about it that makes it interesting.
Yeah, no, exactly. I think it's that thing that, depending on how you view programs and depending also possibly on your age, you're going to pick up on different stuff. So like, yeah, Captain Jack's a perfect example of that, you know. For, and I hate to kind of sound a little bit sexist, but like for a lot of my female friends who were like, oh, he's Johnny Depp and he's lovely and he's great and he'll always be funny, but actually, as you say, yeah, he'll stab you in the back the moment he needs to. So,
and it's clever casting, isn't it? I mean, they cast these actors and in these roles to evoke that exact reaction, don't
they? That's it. Like Elizabeth Rodriguez did the voice of Rafa. She's in Orange is the New Black, and she's a real tough, independent woman.
I love that show.
But yeah, she's, you know, she's kind of like, she's a matriarch of the Diaz house. And actually, there are a couple of lines in that I think it might have been in episode 8, where she's talking about, oh, you're only going back to save Ahsoka because you want to have one up on her, which is the kind of stuff they did in Orange is the New Black all the time.
That's a good spot.
It's some cracking voice acting in the whole episode, you know. It's Ashley Elizabeth and Bridget Canales, I think, who did Trace as well. So yeah, they're a really strong cast.
You make a really good point in terms of the voices. I could listen to Rafa, especially her voice, just listening to her talk is just, I love it. I think she's got a brilliant voice and a great character, and I hope we see more of them. I'll be kind of bleeding over in Together Again now, obviously, as we will, because they're so closely linked, the two episodes. What Trace did by dumping the spice into hyperspace, you look at it as an act of good, inverted commas, and you go, oh, yeah, that's a good thing to do. But then it was also really stupid because it was so impulsive and naive almost.
Massively naive, yeah.
You know, there was definitely... I mean, it's been sort of said in there, and I put it in the review on the site, you know, that Spice, and I think this is a touch of Lucasfilm and Disney, I think we said this last week, being sort of cute in that, well, it's not just for drugs, you know, we can use it for medicine as well. And so you think, well, if Trace had thought ahead, or she'd even spitballed the idea with Rafa and Ahsoka and said, well, let's not send this to the Pikes because they're definitely going to hit, it's going to hit the streets. You know, you saw that drunk Gotal in the one episode that sells them out in Dangerous Debt. And obviously he's holding a bottle, so the inference that he's drunk, but he could have just as easily been shooting up. You know, it's a rough galaxy. But then they could have took that spice somewhere else to a different refinery, and they could have said, oh, we can make such and such vaccine out of this, or we can make such and such medicine out of that. You know what I mean? They've opened the door to it not just being a recreational, inverted commas, drug. It's got multiple uses. So Trace has been kind of silly and not thinking it through. I just love the little intricacies in the characters because it's not black and white. You know, it's great, but it's not black and white.
it's that cliche of it being shades of grey, but I think it's because they don't really know the difference between black and white as such, because they're just there to survive. So they get from day one to day two, and how they get there is down to what they need to do to survive, be it do they need to steal food or do they have to pickpocket somebody to get some credits.
And that goes back to Han and Chewie, though, doesn't it? Because you look at Han and Chewie, that Chewie's big enough, old enough, wise enough. One, he's like 200 years old or 190 years old as he was in Solo. Mm. He can pretty much, I mean, and he's a Wookiee, so he's not constrained by human morality. He's wired differently. So Chewie's probably doing that stuff with Han, one, because there's the whole concept of the life debt, and two, maybe that's just what he wants to be doing right now, you know?
Yeah.
And like, but Han is like, you saw it in Solo, you know, he was raised on the streets of Corellia, he was grifting for Lady Proxima, you know, so he's a pickpocket by trade almost, you know, and then he wants to get away from that lifestyle, but instead of going and doing something, inverted commas, good, he basically does the same thing but on a bigger scale because he's really good at it, and it's like, I'm good at this, I'm a good pilot, and I'm a decent smuggler, and I can fire a blaster, and why not make a living doing this? And it's not until he meets the Rebellion and Leia and Luke and they kind of change his perception, which again, obviously we know by the sequel trilogy, goes back out the window because he's doing it again by then. That's just who he is, isn't it? So, you know.
Yeah, exactly. I think the longer you do it, the harder it is to break these kind of these cycles and these habits.
Yeah.
It's harder to break these habits. So it would be great to see Rafa and Trace, let's say, 5-6 years' time. Yeah. Let's see where they're at. And let's see if actually both Rafa and Trace are still alive. You kind of get the feeling that whilst at the end of the episode, they're like, yeah, we bit enough more we can chew. Give it a couple of weeks, give it a little bit of kind of like distance, and then they'll be like, I bet we could pull this off again. I bet we could do something like this. We could probably double cross them. Interesting. So what, coming back to it, what did you think of the whole kind of backstory behind how Rafa and Trace kind of ended up where they were with, you know, the Jedi and the parents and stuff?
I loved it. It was fascinating because, like you said earlier, it links you back to earlier episodes of the Clone Wars, which, because this has been so well done, and also because, in a sense, this is post-Disney sale canon era Star Wars, you know. So, you know, you've got in Together Again, Maul turns up. You've got mentions of Crimson Dawn in the prior episode. You saw the Maul from Solo when they went to Kessel, rather. So, you know, you've got all of that. But to link it back to those earlier episodes, I mean, this linked back to, I had to do a bit of research. I was trying to find the sequence that they talk about when the ship crashes and Zero's being taken out. I couldn't actually specifically find it, but I think it was certainly, it was in Hostage Crisis, it was at the end of season one. It was good to go back to that for no other reason to see how brilliant animation was even back then.
I could be wrong, but I think that a certain portion of that happens off screen.
Yes, I do as well.
You almost kind of needed to kind of like get your whole criminal minds kind of like pinboard of like your red string out to kind of connect people. But, you know, the Jedi they're referring to is either Barriss or it could be Luminara.
Yeah, I thought Luminara, but yeah, it could be either, yeah.
It could be either. I mean, and the only reason why I thought maybe it could be Barriss is partly because of the fact that Barriss and Ahsoka have got that history.
Yeah.
And that close history from her leaving the Jedi Order. But then, obviously, as you say, it really goes back to almost the Clone Wars movie when Ahsoka and Anakin really kind of uncover Zero's criminal stuff. And that's how he ends up in prison, isn't it, I think, in the first place. So you could kind of say that, yes, Ahsoka can feel guilty because of just like association to the Jedi. And maybe she was thinking, well, if that was me, would I have actually handled that conversation any differently? Given, you know, the training that she'd had, and probably the options are no, she probably wouldn't. She would probably have to say something similar. There's probably like a line that the Jedi have to take when it comes to addressing collateral damage like this. But also, you could almost say that there's kind of like this slight guilt, but maybe if Ahsoka kind of sat there and did the dots, she was like, well, possibly was Zero in prison because of what me and Anakin did back in the Clone Wars movie. That will make sense.
It does make sense.
I rambled it, but yeah.
No, not at all. It's a good link because, and it's a link from the sort of the start of Dangerous Debt to the sort of near the end of Together Again when Bo-Katan turns up. Bo-Katan sees Ahsoka on Obadiah, and then she sort of follows her back to Coruscant and then arrives and says, basically, we need your help. There's no Death Watch anymore, so I need your help to take or to capture or to get Maul, however you want to word it. You know, and so you've gone from Ahsoka feeling all that guilt about what happened with the Jedi, like you just said, you know, where Raffa and Tracy's parents get killed, and then, you know, a Jedi turns up and says, basically, paraphrasing, wrong place, wrong time, but what you going to do? May the Force be with you, and off she goes, which just completely solidifies the contempt the public would have for the Jedi, because the Jedi are just looking down at people now, like Anakin does in Attack of the Clones. Jedi business, get back to your drinks, that sort of attitude. They're the Star Wars superheroes, aren't they?
But yeah, precisely, they are. There's that really fun line where Ahsoka's trying to explain, well, I left the Jedi Order, and both Raffa and Trace say, you can do that at the same time. There's obviously that kind of notion that if you're a Jedi, you're a Jedi for life.
Yeah.
And then when we get to the end of the next episode, Raffa kind of says, you're a Jedi, or the kind of Jedi that I would want Jedi to be. That was nice. And as you say, Bo-Katan comes in. I think one of the very few times that we're now basically being led from one story arc right into another.
Yeah, literally walked into the next plot.
Yeah, which is great. Just a small little thing and a really nice cinematic ending. Just works, doesn't it?
I really enjoyed it. Again, the visuals were great. The music's always great. Voice acting has been phenomenal in this season.
Yeah, I think they've really kind of everybody, and I'd imagine the cast, whether or not they've done it as a conscientious kind of like effort together, or if it's just been like, this is like our second chance to kind of show how good this series is. Let's kind of make sure that every line is delivered as good as it can be, as strong as it can be. And I think that, again, in this episode, they do that really well.
Hello, I'm Warwick Davis, and you're listening to FanthaTrax.
12 months ago, people were in Chicago doing Celebration. It's absolutely flown by. When we were there this time last year, we did have the chance to sit down and have a chat with Lorne Peterson. So let's just listen to the first part of that interview. There's the second part coming later on in the show. But this is me and Lorne Peterson sitting down at Celebration Chicago for a brief chat.
So we're here in room 178AB at McCormick Place, Star Wars Celebration Chicago. I'm here with Lorne Peterson.
Hello.
How are things? How are you?
I am good. I must be fairly well preserved. It was a long time ago that I talked to you on the phone and from England. And I retired. I started at late 29, and I'm now 74 and happily retired and all that kind of stuff.
Are you one of those retired guys that's busier than you were when you were working, or are you chilling out and taking it nice and
well? It's interesting. There are certain times when you're busier than you're ever, because you're capable of. You know, the friends that I worked, the people I worked with became friends, and we all live in somewhat of the same radius, a smaller radius, and so I say, well, I could have lunch every day of the week with somebody if I wanted to, you know.
So you're still in the same part of the world?
The same place.
Yeah.
The same place. They'll take me out of there on a gurney. That's how I will be moving next time.
That's not a bad way to go. Yeah. So when you look back now at your career, what moments... Because we all think of our lives in moments.
Yeah.
What moments stand out? There's got to be certain key moments in terms of your work career.
Right, right. You know, to begin with, the fact that I wasn't looking for a job, I had a small company that was financially kind of failing. Two of us did models and prototypes and design work. And a friend in university just encountered me on the street, and he said, oh, my God, Lauren, haven't seen you in a couple of years. You'd be perfect. We're doing a small science fiction film out in the valley, and do you think you could come out and help? We're looking for model makers. I mean, now you could throw a rock and hit a model maker, especially where we are right now. But then it was hard to come up with professional model makers. And so I said, yeah, well, we'll check it out. And if I could bring my partner with me, he wasn't with me at that time, and he's a real good model maker. And they said, yeah, we really need people. So that was how it started out. But I was another kind of milestone was we were hired for just 2 months to solve a particular problem with the Death Star.
Yeah.
Well, about 3 or 4 or 5 days into it, I realized that what they were putting the models together with was 5-minute epoxy. So they were mixing up little batches of epoxy and putting the parts on and then putting tape over the top of that and then going to some other area and putting tape and on and on and on. I since I worked in industrial design, I was aware of a product that wasn't available to the public called Eastman 910. And it was a product like superglue. It was really the really early superglues. And so what I did was I came in the morning. I brought a pencil. And I had a little bottle of super glue, and I cantilevered a pencil out over the desk, a wooden desk, and I said, everybody should stop. I want to show you something here in the morning. And I did that, and I put a one drop, and I moved my hand, and the pencil, of course, stayed cantilevered with the majority of it over the precipice. Yeah. And there was a gasp, you know, how did you do that, and all that stuff. And so I brought more with me, you know, and so it changed the way that we made the speed and the quality, because you could just, as quick as you could put parts on, you could bond them.
So is problem solving in a sense like that as important as the actual model making itself, if that makes sense?
It is actually. It's interesting you say it that way, because not everybody realizes that. It's because you have to analyze, even subconsciously, you have to analyze the physics of something. Yeah. What and the people I worked with definitely were, you know, like seat of their pants physics people. They were interested in that kind of thing. You know, what does weight do? What does inertia do? What does, you know, that kind of thing?
Yeah.
How do things mechanical things work?
Yeah.
How do organic things work? And boy, we did that the whole career. You know, in a way, one of the things that it sounds rather ordinary, but I was asked a number of times to come up with dirt that would move well in the scale and everything.
Yeah.
And it's and people don't think about it, but it's very rarely that anything crashes into the ground that makes a deep hole.
Yeah.
It's, you know, you can take a dump truck and take it up 50 feet and drop it on the ground, and it's not going to make a deep hole.
No.
And yet, psychologically, it's...
The Looney Tunes thing.
That's the way you think that it's supposed to be, you know. And so for the film, like Men in Black was an example, that one where the ship comes plowing in and the dirt comes flying up and, you know, the little particles of sod go out, that had to be, it was made with vermiculite, and then we bought truckloads of peat moss, put it out in the parking lot, let it dry in the sun, and ran cars and forklifts over it to keep breaking it down smaller and smaller. So peat moss it comes in bogs in England. It's probably called the same thing.
Yeah.
And or does it live in a bog, or it sits in a bog? I guess.
Sits in a bog.
And it has that and Fuller's Earth and vermiculite, another really expanded mica is what it is. It's a mica that's been expanded in a vacuum.
Yeah.
And so all of those things mixed together makes a very light earth that ship can plow into and, you know, go, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So those kind of technical problems have to be solved. So you just can't buy a shovel loads of dirt.
It just wouldn't work.
Trump, it would just stop dead.
Yeah.
And especially since the scale is wrong. You know, you're plowing into a dirt that is real scale, live action scale, and you're taking a miniature ship and trying to plow it into it. And the physics of that are even worse than if you had the real scale thing crashing into real dirt, you know. So, and water is another one of those that Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. Yeah. Do you mind if I talk off angle too?
No, not at all.
Because we were talking about problem solving.
Yeah.
There was a real problem there is that we were dropping about a ton of water, a little bit more than a ton of water down that tunnel.
Yeah.
And water just doesn't want to be miniaturized. It's a droplet of water is a droplet of water, you know, that kind of thing. So Dennis Muren was the one who came up with the idea of we had a huge pressure tank and then these big industrial hoses, like about an inch in diameter, that all faced towards the water. They were hidden behind rocks and they were hidden behind all kinds of, but everything had to be really solid inside that tunnel.
Yeah.
So when a ton of water comes flying down, it comes towards you, but the air, the blast of really strong air is going the opposite way of the water.
Right.
And if you look at that particular scene, it has the scene like the water almost has a mind of its own.
Yeah,
it's struggling to get forward, but it breaks up all of those little droplets that would look like basketballs if it really did head towards
you. It turns them into spray.
Yeah, they just turn into anything that turns small just turns is atomized by the very strong air. And the water looks like it's being held back, but obviously it can't be. A ton of water can't be held back by water. So there are problems like that. There's loads of problems like that that all have to be solved.
So do you enjoy the problem solving as much as you enjoy the model making? It seems like you do.
You know, I became kind of, people would sometimes even things that didn't relate to what we were doing in film, people would say, well, go talk to Lorne and see what he thinks, how we can solve that problem. So a little tooting my own horn, but I'm not the only one that did that kind of thing. There's a guy named Michael, and he, for Wild Wild West, we did this third scale town because they accidentally burned down the town on the first shot. Accidentally burn it down. The water pressure wasn't great. The water would come out right away, but it died down. Yeah. And so the firemen didn't have enough water pressure. They hadn't tested to see if the water pressure would last more than 5 minutes. So we did the town and everything like that. And Michael comes out with these boot things that he put onto the bottom of his shoes, and they have little miniature horseshoes on them.
Right.
And so he walks all over the ground, you know, where the horses are, where they're tied up at the rails and everything, walk, 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 walk. And then we blew it a little bit, so as if the wind had kind of gotten, you know, wiped out some of them.
Yeah.
But it was just he thought, well, it's going to need that little extra sweetness of quality. Of the horseshoes, and he comes with his horseshoe shoes.
A clever idea.
It was very clever.
When we spoke before, you actually mentioned Wild Wild West with the big the rock structures. How you managed to work the physics of them collapsing by putting the ballast in the.
Oh,
the
you knew about that too.
Yeah. That's what made me think about problem solving.
It was. I had thought because the rocks were made out of foam. They looked like real rocks, but they were carved out of hard, like surfboard foam, and. You know, rocks that are Hollywood rocks from the 20s and the 30s just look so phony when they'd throw a rock and hit a cowboy on the head. And we know that it just caught his brain damage, you know, and they'd bounce off their heads and, you know, he'd whip out his gun and shoot the bad guys or something. And so I knew that was just, it would just be the dagger of death to that shot if the rocks bounced. So then I was thinking, well, beanbags. I'm not sure in England it's the same kind of thing as a beanbag, and they have a very dead quality to them because the beans are continuing, inertia is continuing to compress them as they hit the ground, so they don't bounce up, they slide and that kind of thing. And so then I thought, well, how about motor oil with lead shot in it? You know, that'd be to do the same. So I had these little plastic jars come in every size imaginable, from, you know, one thing to anyway. Big rock had a big plastic jar in it with lead, and then we, you know, what degree of thickness of oil we used was important. So sure enough, I found I'd take these jars and you'd throw them, and the lead shot would be the inertia of when you threw it out, and then when it hit, inertia would continue trying to drive those lead shots through thick oil, and so it never would bounce.
Yeah.
So I thought, well, if I can get those bottles into the approximately the center, the center of gravitational of the thing, which we made a big boring tool, you know, that would go into the thing like a big Forstner bit or spade bit, as they're called too. But that worked. And again, it's one of those things that when you're asked to do the thing, no one says what the problem is.
No.
You know, they just say we need to have this canyon collapse.
Yeah.
So all of that stuff, and I was, quite frankly, we worked so hard, you know, because wintertime was coming, and rain in Marin County almost always starts at the end of October.
Yeah.
And the sun angle had to be approximately right, midday, and rock approximately midday, as high as we could get it, and or as high as it would be.
Yeah.
And we worked day and night, and then if the wind was up, it would take the thing down, and we had to wait until the wind would stop. So one morning, I said to the crew, we're going to set it all up. They're going to have the camera crew. We're going to do the shot. And I had attached onto a fishing pole with a small fishing line, I attached a piece of down as an indicator of what was happening with the wind.
Yeah.
And so it would dance around in the little breeze and everything like that. And I would watch it every once in a while. And so I looked over at about 11:30 one time, and it was hanging straight down. You know, I was like, I said, this is it.
Yeah.
We got to go. Got to go. And so everything was prepared and all the stuff. And we took the straps off of it. The cameras got ready. And it worked like perfect, like clockwork, you know. And quite frankly, I went home to go to sleep. And normally your obligation is to set it up three times. I looked at it and I said, it was perfect.
It's not going to get any better.
It was not going to get any better. And I took the opportunity because I just was ready to die. I left the crew there. The crew hadn't been there as much as I had many day after day. And I said, you guys should stay here to, you know, just to see what happens. But it's not going to happen. They're not going to shoot it again. The crew is going to disappear. And they did. And sure enough, in the morning, they loved the first shot. They had no intention of spending more money to get it more perfect. You know, it just wasn't going to be more perfect. Yeah. So that's just another example of problem solving like that. And it is enjoyable. It's like, you know, you get a lot of brownie points, what we would call brownie points. I'm not sure.
It's saving money as well, isn't it?
And saving money. Yeah, right. Yeah, because many times to do a shot over again costs just as much as it did the first time. Yeah. But we usually it's in the budget to do many shots three times.
Yeah.
So in a way, they save two-thirds of the shooting budget. Not necessarily the model budget. Well, some of the model budget, too.
So that must be satisfying because that was one of the key moments in that particular film, wasn't it?
Well, thank you for saying that. The Wild Wild West wasn't the best film in the whole world, that's for sure. I always say that Selma Hayek was one of the best things, and cleavage was one of the best things about that movie.
We've talked about this sort of thing before, haven't we?
Yes, we did. We have talked about it. Maybe it was a fixation or something like that, or I appreciate quality on that regard. But the dynamics between the two characters they didn't seem like buddies.
No.
Yeah, they just didn't seem, they were thrown together rather than being friends.
So that was me and Lorne having a chat this time last year at Celebration Chicago. Have you ever met Lorne Peterson, Mark?
Yes. Yes, I have.
And I ask that in a completely stupid question because from the start of the show, I know you've met Lorne Peterson because you've got a story about Lorne Peterson that I demand to hear.
It's a bit embarrassing, at least for me. I hang my head in shame for this one, I think. So, we're going back to 2007. So, Star Celebration Europe number one in London at the XL Centre. Basically, and I don't know how or what stall he was on, but he was on this one of these big stalls that was there, and he kind of saw me looking at the books, and I was looking at the Sculpting the Galaxy limited edition book. The book is the inside kind of look into the model shop for Star Wars that Lorne wrote, and they did this really nice limited edition one with I think it was like a. Some small models and stuff like that, like Millennium Falcon and the land speeder. Anyhow, so basically, I'm at this stall and I'm looking at stuff. And the American chap with ponytail and that starts talking to me and starts explaining the book. And I thought he was trying to sell me a book. He was literally just trying to push a book on me. And so it wasn't until like finished his conversation and I'd walked away, and probably about an hour later went, "Oh my God, I've just met Lorne Peterson and I didn't realise who it was." And the thing is, the book was about 250.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So I didn't buy the book either. And he really pitched it to me, which if I'd known who it was, probably actually I would have just pulled out the credit card and brought it then and there. In fairness, it's one of those books, along with like Dress in the Galaxy, that one, and even the Star Wars Costumes book, which came out more recently. Those are the kind of books that I think everybody should have in their book collection or on their coffee table. They're just awesome. But yes, I hold my head in shame for that one, I think. This time last year, you were in Celebration. So what's that one standout memory we've had from Celebration last year?
Bumping into mates. There's people over in the States, you don't see them that often, you know, unless they come over here, which is once in a blue moon, where you have a European Celebration, or, you know, we get over there for various things. So it's just nice bumping into people that we know and having the chance to catch up. So, yeah, just generally fanish things, I would say.
Yeah, no, I managed to get to all the panels I wanted to because I was sat at home in London watching the live stream. So I saw all the stuff that they had, which was great, which I think, to be fair, the last two or three celebrations I've been to, I've been fairly involved with the Rebel Legion or heavily involved with the Rebel Legion. So therefore, you don't get a chance to get to many panels. And I think also it's one of those kind of things you just, it's a compromise that you have to accept, really, yeah. Because you're kind of there for a different reason. Bit like when you're hosting a podcast stage. Luckily, it's good that the panels were kind of streamed. But like you say, it's down to the random meetings you have with fans and catching up with people. I mean, because that's the thing. Rebel Legion is a massive club with, you know, thousands of members all over the place. So, you know, the chances of seeing, you know, a tenth of them in any one place is really remote. But it's nice to be able to see, you know, as many people as you can from the club come to one area. And also they always come to the same area. So it's not like you've got to start working out how to spread your time and stuff. So it's always good. You can hang out. And it's amazing because, I mean, I don't know about you, but I always find that with Star Wars fans, I can basically pick up where we left off from last time.
Totally.
Some of the panels, some of the main event panels, so the main stage panels, once you've kind of seen Mark Hamill in that once or maybe twice do that kind of show, they do kind of wheel out the same kind of stories very often. So great if you've never been to a celebration to go and see these people on the main stage. But actually, and this is no disrespect to anybody, I think those are the kind of panels that once you've seen them a couple of times, it's kind of like you can watch a live stream of it later on and don't feel like you're missing out on not being actually at that panel.
That's a really good point, actually. In terms of having a live stream, it means that, you know, us there on the day, I mean, we had the Fantha booth at the time, so that was difficult to logistically organise because you always have to have people there.
Sure.
You know, so it's making sure it's manned. And obviously, you know, people want to be at different panels. But as you say, it's a really good point. A lot of these are on the live stream. And in the world we live in now, I know I could have emailed home and said to a couple of friends at home, can you send me a link to the live stream? And they could have done it. And I could have sat there in a quiet area with Wi-Fi and watched the panel. I could have probably watched the panels whilst I was sitting in the podcast stage. The panels that are of value in many ways are the fan panels. You get a lot of these sort of deep dive collector's track panels that will really go into some nitty-gritty on certain topics, or just general fan discussion panels. I was involved in pitching two or three panels for this celebration, which hopefully will now get sort of pushed back. And again, we haven't heard anything official as we know. And we hear again from Mark from Tops in this episode, later in this episode, the second part of that that interview. Celebration's happening. It's still on. It's not been changed. I think we're all in our heart of hearts kind of expecting it to step back. Yeah, it's the fan panels that are as much fun as anything, because like you say, we said it earlier, you know, you're going to, these people, you speak to them on social media, you catch up with them online. They're the guys you're going to talk to. With the best will in the world, you're not going to have a long, ongoing, drop them a line out of the blue conversation with somebody like Mark Hamill. You know, they're on a completely different plane. But if it's a fellow fan from another podcast or a website or a blog or a costume group person, you're all just pals together, aren't you?
I mean, you say that. I mean, me and Daisy Ridley, we're like that.
There's always an exception, though, isn't there?
Wishful thinking, Moldcaster. I've heard a couple of rumours that San Diego possibly, and this is completely unconfirmed, possibly is now the people, like the kind of the heads of who run that convention are sat down and looks like it might be being canned or pushed back, probably cancelled. But, you know, obviously don't take my word for it, and by all means come at me if that's not the case. You're more than welcome to. It's Mark Newbold at Fan the Tracks, I believe. So.
You beat me to it. I was going to say, yeah, I completely agree, but come at Mark if you want to. I'd heard similar things. And I think given the situation, like I say, these curfews and lockdowns are being extended all across Europe, and they're probably going to be extended in the States and certainly here. The nature of a convention, all these people together in close quarters, you know, I think it's going to change a lot of people's opinions on these events anyway, certainly for the next 12 months, certainly until there's a vaccine. And I know we talked about this at length last episode, but I hope these convention companies can keep it together in such a way that they can survive. I think a lot of companies are going to, potentially some are going to go under.
And the only quote from Star Wars I can think of is from C.O. Bibbo from Phantom Menace, when he says the death toll is catastrophic. But yes. That's kind of how it's getting. And I think, without getting into politics, it's probably quite naive to think this is going to be done and dusted by even the end of May. It's like you said, it's going to have a knock-on effect, and I think it's going to take people actually a long time to kind of get back to, like you said, like, you know, wanting to possibly be in such a large enclosed area, you know, with so many people together. Hopefully we're things will be fine and celebration and that will carry on and everybody will have a great time. So
this is Steve Bloom, voice of Zebraelios, and you're listening to Fantha Trax Caravast. May the force be with you.
Last week on the Fantha Trax, you guys had an exclusive from Hasbro that there's a new Black Series 6-inch figure.
Yeah, we were very lucky. Hasbro got in touch and they said, do you want to be part of something called Star Wars Fan Celebration, which was basically us and 8 or 9 other sites revealing the new figures that were coming out. So there was some vintage collections, some Black Series. Some sites shared the same exclusives. And some of us were lucky enough to have an exclusive to ourselves. So we were very fortunate to be able to reveal there is a new 6-inch Black Series Tebow figure coming out. I shall read the blurb because they sent us blurb. Ages 4 years and up, so don't eat the spear. Retails for $19.99 and it's out fall 2020. So fans and collectors can imagine scenes from the Star Wars galaxy with this Star Wars the Black Series 6-inch Tebow Ewok figure, which is detailed to look like the character from Star Wars Return of the Jedi. And I've got to say, as a sculpt, it really, really does.
Yeah, at least from these photos, it looks like he's furry.
It's brilliantly done.
The texture.
Premium deco, premium deco, and multiple points of articulation. A bit like you, Mark. Star Wars fans and collectors can display this highly poseable. It's got 4 fully articulated limbs. Figure in their action figure and vehicle collection includes figure and 3 accessories available at most retailers. We were pleased to get this reveal because, one, there's always an interest in the Ewoks and such, you know, as a character. And to figure, it just looked the business.
It does. I think it looks great.
In that reveal, there's a carbonised Boba Fett coming out, which I've pre-ordered because the box just looked fantastic.
Yeah, but yeah. I mean, I say I'm not a black 6-inch Black Series figure collector, but I've got all the carbonised figures so far and all of them pre-ordered, but are coming. You say about shiny, that vintage 6-inch Boba Fett convention exclusive last year, that is very shiny because it's on that holographic kind of card. Yeah, I can definitely get as many convention exclusives as I can in either scale, 6-inch or 3¾, but for my general collecting habits, it's vintage collection, 3¾-inch.
But yeah, there's some cracking stuff, and as I say, there was a Captain Rex vintage collection figure, there's the carbonised, or the sort of the shiny-looking Stormtrooper, there was Empire Strikes Back Darth Vader. I think, are you clicking around now looking for the list of figures?
Can you tell? Can you hear it?
Oh, please do it quickly because I can't remember all the figures. But no, because I'm so well prepared. But no, it was a thrill to be involved. It was a really good night. All the reveals happened at 8 o'clock UK time. So we were very cautious because, and this is a commonly held problem, and just completely off on a completely different tangent, I want to give a quick shout out to a guy called Tobias Rose. Tobias Rose, he put on an event, a live streaming event called AFN Con, which I was on yesterday for about an hour. Small event, just Star Wars fans talking about, hey, Star Wars. First time he's done it, he did it just to give people things to do whilst all the real sort of physical events aren't on. So hats off to Tobias. It was a really cool event to be a part of, to get to do a reveal, to have all the sites sharing each other's links. Fingers crossed we'll get to do it again at some point.
There's a K2SO vintage collection figure coming, and then the aforementioned Boba Fett carbonised 6-inch, the Tebow 6-inch, a 6-inch carbonised Stormtrooper, then who else? Oh, then we've got a 6-inch Mandalorian and full Beskar. So we've only had the first couple of episodes old Matt Mando armour. So far, 6-inch Admiral Akbar, which is pretty cool.
The Akbar, that's right. That was revealed by Star Wars Insider, if I remember.
You got that one correct, sir.
Yeah. So it's interesting that a lot of the usual suspects in terms of sites, as well as us, which is cool because we're relatively new, but Insider getting a reveal, I thought that was fascinating that they got a reveal. Really cool.
It's good that they can do that. I mean, because also it's like everybody's really, you know, whilst there's some people get exclusives or one thing or the other, everybody's sharing eventually the same news and working together, and it's all one big happy Star Wars family. So share the announcements by all means.
Hi, this is Gareth Edwards, director of the best standalone Star Wars film since Caravan of Courage, called Rogue One. You're listening to Fantha Trax. Enjoy.
So on the last episode, episode 30, we caught up with Mark Van Olen from Tops, and we talked about Star Wars Authentics reveals that were coming and news that was coming out of New York. Today, second part of the interview, where we talk about the releases from Tops trading cards. So slightly different to last week. So this is me and Mark having a chat about Tops trading cards. One of the Topps trading card series that's coming out that I'm particularly interested in that looks fantastic is your Women of Star Wars set. Can you tell us a little bit about that set?
Yes, this is a long time coming. I was joking that it's 42 years in the making since we had like Princess Leia as the one female character, and now we have an entire trading card set dedicated to the women of Star Wars. So here we are, like the, you know, year 42. We finally have 100 characters that we can put on a base set. Some really interesting inserts, and then autographs from, I think, over 40 different signers. And it actually cuts across, like, the entire saga. So aside from Carrie, we do have some other classic saga signers like Carolyn Blackenston and Femi Taylor, who plays Ula. We've got good prequel signers from, like, Jedi, some of the Jedi women, yeah. As well as Leanna Walsman, who plays Zam Wessel. We haven't had her in, like, over a decade. And then because of the new content, that's really the reason we're able to do this. The new trilogy brought us Daisy and Gwendolyn and Laura Dern, Kelly Marie Tran and Billy Lord. Rogue One has Felicity. The new cartoons with Clone Wars and Rebels brought in a lot of new women signers. And then the video games. Like, we really made this expansive across the entire saga. So it includes signers from Jedi Fallen Order, like Deborah Wilson, who plays Seer. And also Gina Carano from The Mandalorian. She actually technically makes her card debut in this product. And then from Battlefront, we have Janina Gavankar and Misty Lee, who plays Leia in Battlefront. So we've actually got a couple of different Leia signers, because we also have Shelby Young, who plays Leia in Forces of Destiny. So we made sure to celebrate Leia within this product.
It sounds fantastic. Like I say, it's been a long time coming, and Amy Ratcliffe released her her book last year, which obviously focused on a similar topic. So the two things sort of really gel together really nicely.
Yeah, I'm so happy we could do it. Because we thought about trying to do a Women of Star Wars product a couple years ago, and we just didn't have the roster yet.
Yeah.
So we tested it out like as a print-on-demand set last year, and wow, did it sell out fast. Like, it was the kind of thing where it was like, okay, we really do need to turn this into a full-scale product. And that's when we decided we were going to go out and find a lot of the new signers. So I believe it's 8 new signers out of like the 40-something that are first timers for Topps, which is very exciting. Plus, the key leads from across all the different other areas of the property.
Looking forward to that. There's a series 2 of Rise of Skywalker cards coming out as well in June.
We have sort of a cadence of new movies, right? Like I was mentioning earlier about the journey, and then the day and date, and then the DVD timing. So, you know, we did our journey to The Rise of Skywalker back in October, similar to like our journey to The Force Awakens or Last Jedi, where it gets you like prepped for the movie. And then the Series 1 product comes out day and date with the film, but we can't tell you anything. So we've got like all these roster cards of characters and like a few scenes that we're allowed to show, but they have no context. So they'll have like titles or character names, but we can't give away the plot. And especially on this one, there's actually no text on the back of the cards for Series 1 because we couldn't give away anything. It was that secretive. And that's a little bit JJ, and also a little bit that like this is the 9th movie closing up a saga. Like, please don't spoil anything.
Yeah.
So now Series 2 gives us the opportunity to actually tell the story of the film. So there's 100 base cards that actually tell the story of the film, plus a bunch of inserts, and then new autograph signers as well. So we got the expanded list. So in Series 1, we were really only able to use the principal cast, which is great. Those are all awesome signers, like Daisy and Adam and John and Dom Hall Gleason, you know, Billy Lord and Kelly Marie Tran. And then we have a very small selection of secondary characters that we were aware of, that they were definitely in the film and weren't going to be left on like, the cutting room floor or something. Series 2 allows us to expand out because we've got the much larger list of people who have made it into the film, creature actors who we work with, other people from the First Order side, the Resistance side. Like, I think the autograph list is almost twice as big for Series 2. Right. And that'll be coming out in June. So that'll be a really great one. I think that, like, Series 2 is always my favorite version of the product because it tells you the story. So I would recommend people go get that one.
Definitely looking forward to that. Yeah, you've got another Chrome series coming out, to Topps Chrome Perspectives Resistance versus the First Order.
Yes. I love Chrome, and the Perspectives brand is such a cool one. If you guys remember in 2014, we released the first Chrome Perspectives, and it was just called Chrome Perspectives, and it was the Rebel Alliance versus the Empire,
yeah.
Right? And we, you know, and that's the big struggle in Star Wars, right?
Yeah.
But then we did essentially a prequel version with the Jedi versus the Sith, and it was more of like a light side versus a dark side. This is the culmination of this now, where it's all new trilogy focus. So we're taking the Resistance and the First Order, the two different sides of the battle, and it's kind of like propaganda storytelling, where Each side thinks they're the good guys. So like the writing on the back of the cards is all about like, you know, the goals of, you know, the resistance versus the goals of the First Order. And then we've got autograph signers from across all three of these films. So it doesn't include the resistance cartoon for the autograph signer list, but it does capture the three movies in this age of resistance time period. So Force Awakens, Last Jedi, Rise of Skywalker, you'll see autograph signers from all of those films. So it'll include, again, like Daisy, Adam, John, Gwendolyn Christie, Laura Dern, Domhnall Gleeson, Kelly Marie Tran, Billy Lord, you know, all of our regular principal cast members, and then all of the supporting cast that we can find. There's a lot of them. There's the new people coming in. So once they're in-house, I'll be able to announce who they are.
Obviously, we're all, if we're being smart about it, we're all safely ensconced in our houses, working from home, enjoying our fandom from home. But we can't help but look forward to the back end of the summer when hopefully Celebration will be happening. Any word on the status of Celebration at the moment? What's the plans with you guys?
Yeah, so we're working full steam ahead as if the show is still happening. So right now it's April 2nd. The show is scheduled for the end of August. So we still have like just a little under 5 months of preparation. But, you know, as of right now, the show is still on. And if anything changes, by the way, I keep telling people, you won't hear it from me. Like the official Star Wars channels will be the ones to announce any type of changes, yeah. Whether it be like a delay or a cancellation or anything like that. I know there was a lot of chatter yesterday about San Diego Comic-Con. They actually released a statement saying they're still hoping to have their show, which is in Southern California in July. So I think people are also looking at that. Obviously, the state of the world, like we can't control what's happening externally, except stay home, people. Like if you all stay home, we have a chance of being able to go back out again ever. So but like, you know, when it comes to Celebration, we're doing a lot of planning behind the scenes right now and securing talent and working on the floor plan. We actually just had a meeting last week to go over some very granular stuff about how many lanes we need. So we're working as if the show is still happening end of August.
Brilliant. Well, fingers crossed we can all be there. Fingers crossed that the world is in a state that we can sustain doing it. Let's fingers crossed. And everybody, like you say, everybody stay at home. The sooner we get this isolation period out of the way, the better chance we've got of beating this thing.
Exactly. Help us out by not leaving your apartment, please.
Exactly. Stop at home and watch television. It's the dream, isn't it? Isn't this what we all dream of? Just stop at home and watch television all day. Is there anything else tell us? Anything else you can tell us about what's coming from Tops?
Yeah, there's so much going on. It's almost hard to keep track of. You know, the trading card team has releases all throughout the year. So we already talked about Women of Star Wars, which just came out, and Rise of Skywalker Series 2, and then Chrome Perspectives. They've also got a Mandalorian trading card set that's going to hit around October. So that'll be like roughly when Season 2 hits. So the idea is that this will be the Season 1 set, and it'll include those signers that I mentioned earlier, like Gina Carano, Nick Nolte, Werner Herzog, Omid Abtahi, Giancarlo Esposito. And there are some new signers that we can't announce quite yet. As you can imagine, we're trying to bring Mandalorian talent to Celebration as well. So, you know, we're hitting both of those at the same time. And then I think they're planning on a couple more sets for the year. I know there's a Masterwork coming. I don't have any details on that one yet, but there is a Star Wars Masterwork in the works for 2020. And then on my side, on Star Wars Authentics, our big thing is we're constantly pushing out photos, as you can see.
Yeah.
So, you know, photo ads are usually – I mean, every week we've got them for Clone Wars now, and that'll go through May. And then after that, it'll be sort of like biweekly drops of new photos. And as we're planning for Celebration, as we confirm talent, we'll add new stacks of photos for those actors. And then as the year goes on, certainly with Mandalorian Season 2 coming back, we'll do the same thing where we've got new images after each episode. So we plan on replicating that whole program. There was also a Tops Now program associated with Mandalorian for Season 1. I assume we'll bring that back for Season 2. And then also on the Star Wars Authentics front, we just released our blind pack with the 11x14 size. We've got another one coming out in June back to the standard 8x10 size. So that one is out now for solicitation. So I think orders are due pretty soon on that one. And it'll be in your local hobby shops and distributors, I think at the end of June.
So it's all go. Nothing stops for Star Wars, does it?
No. And that's the thing is like we're full steam ahead. And if anything, you know, I mean, baseball is a little bit strange right now because we don't know what the season's going to look like. But Star Wars seems to be unaffected, at least, you know, content wise. Like it's the same content that we were planning. I don't know if there have been any like production shutdowns or anything like that. Like, it didn't seem like they were filming the Ewan McGregor Obi-Wan Kenobi show or even the Diego Luna show anyway.
Yeah.
So I don't think that there's going to be any delay in the content that I'm specifically working on. And for us, like, doing private signings, once the quarantine embargoes are lifted, like, it's not a problem to go to one person's house. Like, the issue will be, like, can you go to conventions? And that's something that we'll keep an eye on. But being able to execute our private signings, like, we've got several planned for May and June. We anticipate that those are going to happen. So unless anything changes from, like, a government mandate perspective that we need to push those things out, I assume that things are moving full steam ahead. And if anyone does want to shop the new collections at Star Wars Authentics, we do have a code to save 10%. So if you visit the site, use the code SWASAVE10 and you'll get 10% off your order. And there's no exclusions on that. So you can use it on, like, the Harrison Ford autograph. You can use it on whatever you want.
Brilliant. Well, we really appreciate you taking the time to fill us in on what's happening with Topps and with Star Wars Authentics. Always welcome over at Fantatrax, and hopefully speak to you again soon. Here in the UK, Disney Plus is up and running, and we are catching up. We've already caught up with The Clone Wars, but we're catching up with The Mandalorian. So this week, episode 5 of The Mandalorian, The Gunslinger, landed. We reviewed it on the site a while back when it released in the States, but now it's here for Disney Plus UK and Europe, of course. I thought it might be a good chance to talk about the episode again. So, Mark, your thoughts on The Gunslinger. What did you make of this particular episode?
I really liked it. You've probably heard that from me a few times already about Mandalorian episodes. I thought it was great. I think it was just really nice coming back to Tatooine. Again, a bit like with the previous chapter, there was a little bit of not so positive press and reviews about this, and people thought this was really overtly hitting the fan service button a little bit too much. But I didn't really feel that way, in fairness. It's not like we really go to Tatooine very often, and it's certainly not like we go to Mos Eisley very often, in my mind anyway. So it was really nice to go back. I thought the episode, again, was a really tight episode. And, I mean, it didn't really, I don't think, do a huge amount to kind of push the character forward or the story massively forward, I don't think. But it was kind of nice, and it was nice to see Ming-Na Wen's character in the episode. And the actual gunslinger himself, I thought, was really cool. Toro Calican. And it's funny, actually, because, you know, we're talking about Trace and Raffo and the Clone Wars about being young and naive, and that he is probably the quintessential young and naive and slightly arrogant, inexperienced bounty hunter. I mean, it looked beautiful. I don't think you could get much more Western in Star Wars than this episode. You know, that is pretty much the pinnacle of, like, the Western influence is definitely evident in this episode. It's nice, and I thought it was, like I said, beautifully shot, and there's lots of, like, heavy use of, like, silhouettes near the end of the episode. So I think it's fun. I mean, like I said, it didn't massively, I don't think, do too much to move the character on, really, other than just, again, just shows that he can't really rest on his laurels at all at any point. What did you think of it? Did you think that it was too fan servicey, or did you think it was enough?
You know, I'm always a bit cautious around that phrase of fan service, because I'm not quite sure who else you're supposed to pitch your shows to. If it's gimmicky Easter egg, sly wink raking the wall, nod of the hat to stuff, that's fan service to me. That's too much. That's like, all right, guys, we get it, it's Star Wars. But if it's things like this, you know, we land on the planet, we land at, I think it's like Docking Bay 35 or whatever, so you land in the Docking Bay and you look at the writing on the wall, it actually says 35, like Docking Bay 94 actually said 94, but in a weird font. You know, stuff like that, it's like, clever. You see the pit drawers, it's like, straight away you're thinking Phantom Menace. Oh, clever. And there's all these little touches. You go into the cantina, you see EV-99 behind the bar, you know, all these little things. It's like it was Star Wars, 10 years on or whatever it is, you know. It's just so clever the way they did it, but it didn't feel like fan service. All the people saying, oh, it's, you know, and a lot of it was fans sort of going, oh, it's a fan service for the older fans sort of thing. It's like, no, Star Wars is for everyone. It's as much fan service for you as it is for me. It's just that I kind of have slightly different throwbacks because I've been around it a bit longer and read different material than newer fans might have read, but it's all there for everyone to read. It's just, you know what I'm getting at. It's, you know, if you read a comic in 1979 when you were 8 years old or whatever you may be, you're going to have a different kind of connection and different hook to it than somebody that just happened to read it a day ago. You know, it's just the nature of these things. But no, I loved it. I thought Toro Calican was a really interesting character in the sense of he was obviously playing fast and loose with his situation in that he clearly wasn't quick enough and smart enough to do this himself. So he was clever in the sense that he got somebody on side that he thought would help him get to where he needed to go. But he had a massively inflated opinion and value of what he could bring to the whole situation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the fact that he shot dead Ming-Na Wen's character was a lot of people criticised it and said, what a shame that she's out of it. I don't think she's out of it. That he did that, I actually thought was quite smart because she would have killed him in a heartbeat. It just took me back to Beckett and Solo at the end of Solo. When Beckett's like, you did the right thing, I would have killed you. And I just thought about that because it's like, she would have killed him if she could have done. You know, so there's this whole dog-eat-dog scenario. And like you say, it doesn't really advance Mandalorian as a character, but it does show you that he's not a fool. The only thing he's ever foolish about is leaving his ship in places it shouldn't be left with the door open. That's the only thing he does that I just cannot fathom. But everything else he's pretty clued up about.
I loved it.
Yeah, the whole speed. Just that one sequence when they're just riding across the dunes.
Yeah, on the sweeps. Yeah.
I was so happy watching that. And, you know, and you see the banthers and just all that sort of stuff. I was like, yeah, this is just... I loved all of that.
Completely agree. I think without kind of spending too much on the fan service thing, I kind of think that they had fun with it. It's one of those things like, okay, if you're in the cantina and you've got this, I mean, the episode's called The Gunsling.
Yeah.
So what are you going to do? You're going to put somebody sat at that table where Han was, and you're going to have him kind of lounging with his feet up. When I was watching this, I could almost probably hear kind of like Jon Favreau kind of saying, hey, wouldn't it be cool if we did this?
Yeah.
And I think it just goes to show they're having fun with it.
That's a bit, now I've got to say, sorry to jump in. I think you saying that phrase, wouldn't it be cool if, I bet that gets said an awful lot on this production.
Absolutely.
Wouldn't it be cool if?
For instance, if above his head there was still like a blaster mark from Greedo's blaster or something,
yeah,
then that might be a little bit on the nose. When I think of fan service, I think one of the clearest moments of fan service is in The Force Awakens when Finn pulls out the Jedi training remote, because he pauses, he looks at it, and it's almost about to break the fourth wall, almost like he's looking into a camera. That is why I consider fan service. This was kind of all very much in universe. Now, obviously, you could probably play like either a drinking game or a game of like Tatooine bingo, because all the famous locations pretty much get mentioned, you know, in some way or another.
I think Mos Espa even gets mentioned, doesn't it?
Mos Espa, yeah, by Ming, her character, she mentions that that's where she was going. And a couple of times I think they stick out a little bit, but maybe that's not necessarily fan service. That might just be just like bad delivery, or they could have just not said that, could have said something different. I don't know. It's difficult because I mean, probably if we were writing this, we would probably do a similar kind of thing. And I guess we've got to remember that these locations and this kind of like terminology and colloquialism should be everyday kind of like language for these people and these inhabitants. And it's just the fact that we've just been dropped into it and we've got the history and we understand what X means and what Y means and, you know, Beggar's Canyon and all that kind of stuff. That's why it kind of feels like it sticks out a little bit. Amy Sedaris' character was pretty cool.
What, Ripley?
Yeah, Minnie Ripley. I mean, even down to how she kind of first talks to Baby Yoda just reminds me of how Ripley talks to the cat massively. And obviously you've got the perm and the kind of a jumpsuit, and that was quite a nice nod. And I think this comes up again later with the episodes with like Bill Burr and people like that. They seem to be using a lot of fairly well-known American comedic actors for these kind of supporting role characters, which at least when you listen to the American podcasts, they all know who these people are. But I have no idea who Bill Burr is, and I don't think I know who Amy Sedaris is. So it's quite interesting because it's like I just take her for the character she is rather than who she's played before.
But don't you prefer that, though, the fact that you don't know who
Absolutely.
It is?
Absolutely. But actually, I think also the one thing that did slightly, again, in the very first episode, although it's kind of tongue-in-cheek, pull me out, and it immediately made me think of Dave Filoni, was obviously the bounty hunter Pucks, because we know he's a big ice hockey fan. That was just one of those things that I immediately went, that's just a little bit too kind of like on the nose.
That's clever. I've got to say, I hadn't put the two together, but now you say it, yeah, he is, isn't he? But yeah, I hadn't thought of that. But yeah, that's kind of cute. That evaded me. That's a good one.
I mean, maybe that's actually, yeah, maybe that's just me.
No, I think you're right. No, I think you're right.
You know, but coming back to this episode, I thought like Pelimoto, I think Amy Sedaris' character was Pelimoto. Yeah, she was cool, and I really liked that kind of interaction with the pit droids, or I guess the hangar droids.
Hangar droids, that's true, yeah.
Yeah, they're fun. Still very much like the Three Stooges. So I
wonder if they're Odie Mandrell's old pit crew. I'd love to know.
Yeah.
He had the three, didn't he?
Yeah, but did they end up being, like, sucked in through, like,
One of them did, but he survived.
Yeah, I suppose he did, didn't he?
Because they were quite clearly speaking Spanish, weren't they?
Yes, they were.
So yeah. I'd love to know if that was... I don't know if it's been said anywhere, but this being the three of them, it's like, I wonder if that's Odie's old pit crew.
Possibly.
Yeah.
You can imagine that if he did so badly on the Boon to Eve Classic, but actually he sold the pit droids to Watto or something, and yeah. Yeah, exactly. It's all connected, isn't it? It's all connected. But no, I mean, I thought it was a cool character, and the pit droids are cool. Yeah. Do we think Fennec Shand is still alive?
I think so. I mean, I don't know. We still don't know whose boots that was sort of stepping up to at the end. I mean, there's been loads. Some people think it's Cad Bane. Some think it's Boba Fett. I don't know.
I don't think it's Fett.
No, I don't think it's Fett. I think they'll save that right till the very end of the show, if they ever bring it back, which I'm not entirely convinced they will or should.
It's a big thing to drop, isn't it? I mean, it's Darth Maul level.
And the Emperor. You've had it twice now. You've had Maul come back from being chopped in half. You've had the Emperor come back from being blown up on an exploding battle station. They got away with it with both of them to varying degrees. If you bring back Boba Fett, who was the other big bad guy that died, then, yeah, people might start going, oh, you know. So I think they might have to skip that one.
I suppose the only saving grace could potentially be that actually we get to see a Boba Fett that we've read about in the comics rather than what we've seen on screen, because the Boba Fett that we, you know, especially see in Return of the Jedi is not the Boba Fett that really, I mean, a lot of fans think of. And to be fair, actually, from The Mandalorian is closer to that kind of Boba Fett that I think we've always wanted.
Hello, I'm Ahmed Best, and you're listening to Fanthatrax.
Talking about character as well, because everything links together, music, effects, script, model work, every element works. When you're working on, let's say, pick a film, Return of the Jedi, you're working on a film like that, and there's all the problem solving that goes there, and there's all the characters that are involved, and there's all the different elements moving about. Does that help you visualise, make things work? Does it feel like it's more of a cohesive whole when everything's ticking the boxes?
Yeah, for sure. It does. An example of that is either the water down the tunnel in Temple of Doom, or what we call water out the rock wall when it does that final thing. It's such an orchestrated event. Everybody's the team has to be doing all their part at the right time. Now the trigger has to go off at this time. This has to shoot out the front. This has to the dirt goes into the water at one particular time and all that stuff, and the thing has to be hoisted by the forklift. So there's a lot of one time on. The big water tank tip for Indiana Jones. Yeah, Raiders, Temple of Doom. It was raining. It was like we had a big plastic tent, but by that time the rain had stopped, but the wind is flapping away and noise and everything. They're shooting. And one of the cameramen said, God, I'm really going to have a hard time panning with the tank because I have to look, and I can't tell when the tank actually, the water tip starts to tip off the edge and all that stuff. And so I said, what I'll do is I will attach a string, a pretty substantial string, to his ankle. And what I'll do is I will, I'll maintain a little bit of tension on it. But as it starts to go, I will increase the tension on the thing on your ankle. Yeah. So he would be able to pan, know when, you know, like tension. And it worked just perfectly. You know, just something as simple as a string on somebody's ankle. But those are problems that we didn't even know that they were a problem until
you got to it.
It wasn't like you got to anticipate a month ahead of time that would be something. He just said to me, you know, well, I'm going to have a really hard time anticipating exactly when the tip arrives because I only get to see a little bit, you know.
Yeah. I mean, you won the Oscar for Temple of Doom, so, and there's a lot of innovation in that film.
Yeah.
And again, we've said it, problem solving. So what was the most challenging element of that particular film? Because there was so much going on in that shoot, you know, to make it work to the level that it did.
Right. Well, there were zillions of them, you know, of problems. Even, you know, I mean, it's a kind of a simple thing, but matching... Willie's outfit when she gets lowered into the lava. And and one of the things, the lava was, it was this methacil with a crust on it and the lava and everything in a big spiral. We had to, excuse me, we had to figure out how to make a big thing and light it from underneath, you know, and normally you go to a plastic store and it's all 4x8 and all that stuff. And me and a couple of other model makers were having a lunch in this place. And it was like a Caribbean kind of restaurant. It had a big skylight. And I looked up and I said, that's not a 4x8 piece of plastic. That's 10 by 10 or 12 by 12.
Yeah.
So I thought, there must be somewhere you must be able to get 12 by 12 pieces of plexiglass.
Yeah, yeah.
And I phoned around and phoned around and phoned around. No, no, no. And finally I found, I got in touch with the skylight company.
Right.
What it is, I think I brought back a microscope, not a microscope, a magnifying, not magnifying glass, a binoculars.
Yeah, yeah.
And I looked up to see what the brand name of the company was. There was a little label on the skylight. And they wondered, well, what in the world is he doing? And I contracted with them because they form plastic and everything. They blow mold plastic. And then they, to make the cone, they had an escape for the lava had to be, flatted out the edges and then go into like a whirlpool cone. And even then, the pump, the methacil pump was 8 inches in diameter. The tubes were and everything like that. And I went to an engineer, and a hydraulics engineer. I paid some time with him, and said, actually, that was on a different film where I brought him a bucket of what we wanted to run through a pump, and he said, I don't think I can get a pump. I can get you a shovel, though, that you can do with that. That's a little too thick for a pump, you know.
Yeah.
But anyway, just the system of running through and then filtering out the crust on the thing and then returning it to the top, to spiral, all that kind of stuff is very difficult. But a rather seemingly minor one is matching Willie's outfit. It's a silk made in India with a certain color with little silver dots. The silver dots were about a little bit more than an inch apart. And one of the women at work had lived in India for a long time. She knew a lot about the Indian fabric stores over in Berkeley because a lot of Indian people live there. And we went over there, and lo and behold, we found silk fabric with little silver dots that were a quarter inch apart. And so that meant we were doing a quarter scale is what we wanted to do, a quarter scale Willie. So just fortuitously, I was thinking we were going to get silk and we had to put the little silver dot, dye it and then get the little silver dots on it.
Yeah.
And lo and behold, there it was,
I see.
So we really lucked out on that one. But it's, you don't think of a model maker going to a fabric store and searching for materials, even in E.T., we had to do that. The dry grassy field with E.T. and a little fence and a nighttime view of Los Angeles in the distance.
Yeah.
And I went to a fabric store near work that I'd gone to many a time. And lo and behold, I found phony fur that was this color of white light straw that was about 3/4 inch thick.
Yeah.
And kind of cheap fur. It didn't look like it was the kind of when I was a kid, mothers used to have on the back of the toilet a little furry kind of thing, and then around, I don't know if mothers in England did that too. And it was that kind of a fur, not even if you'd call it animal fur, it was just fuzzy stuff. And lo and behold, when we took a little broken straw, we'd cut from a brush, a cheap brush, you'd cut the bristle off, and that becomes the little weeds and everything, and you'd stick the little weeds in the fur, and that became the summertime field in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
Dried out, a lot of bristly weeds sticking out of grass and all that stuff. And then you just lay it over foam, and you got this lumpy foam, and then it evens itself out and made a really good hill. So that was another example of just finding a material that works. But you kind of have to have a lot of different materials in your mind to like a palette, to be able to draw upon. And where, in some ways, in my head, I used to, people would say, well, where would I get, and say, oh, that's Acme International down in San Jose, a company, I don't know their phone number, but Acme International will be, easy to get, or, oh, there's a company in Pittsburgh that does that kind
of thing. So your Rolodex is constantly filling it with all these solutions.
One of the guys in one of their departments, he said, Lauren, you could sell your Rolodex for quite a bit of money in Los Angeles if you wanted to, or in Northern California, too, because it was just packed with stuff. And I never did that, but it seemed kind of odd to me if somebody wanted to know some information. But other film companies could use something like that.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
That's what it was.
Yeah.
But I didn't want to do that. But, yeah, it was a very full – that was prior to computers, of course.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, model making now is – works in conjunction more with the CG aspect.
Yeah.
Does that make it a completely different process, or is it very much a similar process?
You know what? There are still model makers out there. There isn't like Lucasfilm model makers. There is in England, but 3D printing really. And we came up with, we did have laser cutters by the time we did even back in Peter Pan and Hook and Pirates of the Caribbean and all that stuff. We had laser cutters, which we had one that could do 4x8 sheet of plywood, you know, birch ply, that kind of thing. So that really helped. And then 3D printers came along right at the end and changed the thing. You know, there's a number of periods of, you know, year after year in which the relationship between CG and models was just really beautiful. You know, because it doesn't take a really good eye to tell that some of the quality prior to digital, yeah, as to when digital came along on mats, was just, they could just make perfect mats. You know, there was no little blue line around anything, that kind of thing. And at one time I was describing to one of the women at work, the producers was next to me, and I said, yeah, it's kind of a hand and glove relationship right now. And she says, well, sometimes it's a fist in a glove relationship.
Yeah.
Not always a hand in glove relationship, you know. you know, CG kept champing at the bit, you know.
Yeah.
They kept doing better and better. And I used to compare it to, in England, you wouldn't have the legend of John Henry. I don't think so. And that was, John Henry was a steel driving man. And he was a big man who could hammer in spikes into rails,
yeah,
when they were laying the railroad in the 1850s or something like that. And so he was like so strong and he could do it so fast. And then the steam nailer came along, you know, and John Henry went faster and faster in the steel nailer and the competition between the two of them. And finally, John Henry expired and couldn't last any longer. And I was thinking, so I thought it was a little bit like that. You know, they're the steam nail machine,
yeah,
and we were the hand pounders of the nails into the railroad. And the faster we worked, they were always right behind us, you know, driving us forward, that kind of thing.
Well, I think you got the best of it. I think you got the best stories as well.
Oh, really? Okay, well, good. Yeah, I don't think anybody else is using steel driving man and and that kind of thing.
Super. That's fantastic. Thanks for your time.
Oh, sure.
Really
sure.
Enjoyed it.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's really been good to catch up again.
Earlier on, you told a story about when you met Lorne Peterson back at Celebration Europe, back at the London XL, back in 2007. And you told a story about when you met Lorne, or kind of sort of met Lorne in a weird roundabout way. I have a small story about Lorne. I interviewed him around about the same time and we had a really good chat. But before we got into the meat and bones of the conversation about his career working at Lucasfilm and ILM and all the other projects he did after Star Wars, you know, including things like that, Wild Wild West. Wild Wild West was the one that really stood out to me because he has some fascinating stories about that. We talked about when he was here in the 70s and working on different projects. And he said to me, do you guys still have the sun? Bear in mind, this is like 12 years ago. This is not today. This is 12 years ago. I said, yeah, we still have the sun, the newspaper, the sun. Tabloid newspapers, different to what they get in the States. He says, do they still have Page 3? I says, yeah, because we did then, yeah. He goes, oh, wow, I could never believe that. I could never believe that because I found it fascinating that you guys had naked women in newspapers. Well, that's Britain for you. And then he got talking about Jenny Agutter. He said, I had a real crush on Jenny Agutter. I says, what, from, like, you know, Logan's Run and all that? Like, he says, yeah, yeah. He just talked for about 10 minutes about this massive crush he had on Jenny Agutter. And it just struck me as the weirdest preamble I've ever had to a conversation that I would talk to an Oscar-winning, Temple of Doom, won't even the Oscar, Oscar-winning Hollywood legend about Page 3 of The Sun and Jenny Agutter. And it just struck me as being kind of cute and funny.
That is very cute and very funny. Bless him.
Hey, man, it's me, Kevin Smith, Star Wars fan, Fantatrax fan.
You have a listener's question for us to 2 hours yes, to talk about.
We actually did. Dan from Lincoln, he says, "Hey Mark, just finished reading the Rise of Skywalker novel and was wondering what you both thought of the chances of someone writing any further stories about the sequel characters, and where do you think they would take the characters?" Thanks, Dan, for that. That's quite a good topic for us to talk about. I'm going to throw you in the deep end. And what do you think?
Well, I have actually thought about this. I've got a sort of a throwing it out into the cosmos pitch for a Disney Plus TV series that should happen after Rise of Skywalker. My pitch is, it's basically the Star Wars version of Scooby-Doo. The Millennium Falcon is the Mystery Machine, and you've got Beaumont, Connix, Rose, Babu Frick, and Claude all on the Falcon, going around the galaxy, solving sort of slightly sort of Vader's Castle-style spooky mysteries. Got to be written by Kevin Scott. Detective story, where they've got to figure out who's doing these crimes, and it can be sort of like classic Star Wars, sort of, you know, stopping a smuggling ring or going to a planet where they're, you know, the people think they're being haunted by an ancient deity, and you find out it's, you know, it's the old guy that ran the museum who's doing it to steal the, you know, anything like that.
Yeah.
Something really almost lighthearted, but the good thing is that you can have cameos from all characters that you know. You go back to wherever the Resistance headquarters, because it wouldn't be a Resistance base because the First Order's gone, so they've got the Republic's back in charge, presumably the Republic comes back, and, you know, and wherever their headquarters would be, you know, the Republic headquarters. If Rey does start up a Jedi Academy, where would she want it to be? I think she should have it on Naboo. That's just me. And all these different things. So, you know, you could have the rest of the galaxy happening behind it, like the Cassian TV series will have Cassian as a focal character, but you've still got the build-up to the Rebel Alliance forming behind that. So I think you could tell a really cool little story. So that would be what I would like to see, because I think Rey would, at some juncture, try and do what Luke tried to do, but she hasn't got the ties of specific ties of family in the same way that Luke did, because he'd got a brother-in-law and a sister and nephew. You know, he'd got different considerations that were swaying him, and all the weight of, like, you're the guy that saved the galaxy by helping kill the Emperor, all that legendary weight on his shoulders. Rey's got it, but to a lesser degree, I would say, because one, those two films, well, the three films take place over, what, about a year? Something like that, you know, like, I think Rise of Skywalker's only a year or so after Last Jedi, isn't it? I think it's about 12 months after. And Last Jedi and Force Awakens are essentially one film split in two. You know, they completely seg into each other. So she's not had the years of becoming galactically famous that Luke and Leia and Han and Chewie and all those guys did. And then all the intervening years as well. So that would be my pitch. I would like to see some of the less focused upon characters get more of a sort of a moment in the spotlight, but it's got to be on the Falcon because it's the Falcon.
My mind is absolutely blown by that. Whatever. Have you got a name for this pitch?
For the show? Let me think of a name for that, and I'll put it out in next episode. I'll properly put my pitch together with a name.
If anybody has any suggestions, please write in. I think. to be fair, actually, I could see something like that as an animation going down that kind of Warner Brothers kind of animation style kind of thing. That'd be quite fun. Was it? No, Hanna-Barbera, wasn't it?
Yep.
Hanna-Barbera.
I'm related distantly to William Hanna.
Oh, really?
Yep. My Uncle Stephen's sister, her husband was William Hanna's nephew. So I'm very, very, really distantly related to
what him. Does that make you? Yeah, that's really cool. But that's something to put on a business card, I reckon.
But what does that make me? Yes.
Okay, but I mean, in fairness, coming back to it, we saw in the leaked Colin Trevorrow script and kind of treatment outline that at the end of Rise of Skywalker, there would be some kind of Jedi training academy of some kind. Of it was, wasn't it ran by Rose and Finn or something, and then Rey comes back. Is that right? I vaguely recall something like that. Or at least what had happened was Rose and Finn had collected these four sensitive kids, and then Rey does come back. Which, to be fair, yeah, I suppose it's a difficult one, because like you say, if you don't have the expectations of the galaxy resting on your shoulders, that does give you a greater level of freedom. Because, and I think also, it'll be interesting to find out what people say. You know what I mean by that. So basically what I mean is, obviously at the time, the focal point is for the fact that there's a First Order occupation over most of the galaxy. Now, you could kind of find, I think a lot of people would find it really hard and really difficult to swallow if they kind of were told that actually the Emperor was behind it. He was kind of still slightly alive, but don't worry, it's all good now because we killed him. So I kind of wonder how much of that happens at Exegol actually kind of ends up being seeking out into the wider kind of like consciousness of the galaxy. Because you kind of think that, that's probably one of those things people like, let's just keep that one
under our hats, on
the down low a little bit.
Yeah.
I mean, and even actually, I mean, I don't think we find out, I've not read it anyway, what Lando's message is. So, does he mention the Emperor?
Doesn't the scroll up say that the Emperor basically puts a message out to the galaxy? The whole galaxy's on note, so they know he's back.
They know he's back, that's true. But do people believe that?
True.
That's exactly the thing. Yeah. And because that's one of those, could that just be a First Order ploy to try and transition the First Order from whatever the First Order is into the Empire? Because there's that whole thing, isn't it? Like people were saying, you know, there's rumors throughout the galaxy that Emperor Palpatine would kind of use holo masks and stuff like that, so people wouldn't actually see how he looks and stuff like that. Basically, that's the theory. Because in theory, what Kylo wants to do is he wants to go out and he wants to take down the Emperor and then take over the Final Order's ships to then basically become the Emperor. So that makes sense. So you kind of almost, I think it would almost make sense from a story perspective, from like a news perspective, that people were to just keep it as like just the First Order. Imagine the Emperor's kind of influence will be maybe kind of downplayed quite a bit, just to kind of keep it easier for people to understand. I think possibly Rey could start up a Jedi Academy, or maybe, maybe necessary. Again, it's that whole thing of like, would she, I mean, she's taken on the Skywalker and a surname, but kind of assumes that possibly she would also take on the Jedi moniker as well.
That's a good point. And would she still call them Jedi, or a lot of people said, you know, oh, they could be called Skywalkers instead of Jedi when people were thinking into the title. But a thought occurred to me was, and I think we'll see a lot of this with the High Republic as well, is that obviously the Jedi, as an organisation, if you like, lost their way. Luke found Acto. Yep. And I wonder if, I recently watched Attack of the Clones, and Kamino has been wiped from the Republic maps. And you have the whole sequence where, you know, Obi-Wan goes to try and find the maps, and he's told that, you know, if it's not on the map, it doesn't exist, that whole concept. So I wonder, did the Jedi still know where Acto was, or was Acto completely lost because it was Luke that was tracking down where Acto was? You know, they were going out on all these missions. It was with Lando trying to find different things to trace things down, and where places were, where Exegol was, and all these different things. So did the Jedi Order know? And the reason I say that is because the Journal of the Wills, basically the books, were all on Acto. Rey has got those books, and you think the Jedi had all that knowledge written into those physical books, and they had all the initial knowledge that made the the Jedi Order become great and become what it was, but they lost their way. And I wonder whether at some juncture they just, Acto was struck from the records, they lost control of where it was, they don't know where the books were. Rey, going back to the earliest source of Jedi lore in the Journal of the Wills, maybe she can start a new Jedi Order that's pure, that's not
strip
tainted.
Back.
Yeah, strip yeah. right back. That's not tainted by all the stuff that brought them down in the end.
Yeah. I mean, because I think, knowing that we know that Vader and the Emperor had access to the Jedi archives after Order 66, and the Emperor had sent Vader out to try and collect different artifacts and stuff like that, and he himself would do that. You would have thought that that would have been one place that they would have gone.
Yeah.
So the fact that they didn't would suggest that either through time, because, I mean, we don't really know how far back, really, that first Jedi Temple was formed. I mean, it's built into a tree. It's not even really, you know, like a big kind of building like we've seen in Rebels and stuff like that for these kind of Jedi temples. So it does give Rey that opportunity to kind of go, right, okay, so what is the essence of the Jedi? And that is, I think, the question. What is the essence of Jedi? And from that, you can extrapolate it. And then actually, you know, the first questions you've got to ask is a Jedi just pure light? Is a Jedi dark and that? And is there a balance? And all those questions she needs to kind of like, I guess she needs to either come to her own conclusion, or basically she's got to instruct those who come after her to find their own way. but understand that things need to be kept in some kind of like semblance of balance.
This is Desert Planet Discs. Coolest sounds this side of Moss Eisley.
We've both got copies of Art of Rise of Skywalker.
Do.
It would be remiss of us not to have a little flick through the book. I literally have it in my hands right now to have a flick through it. And it's difficult to sort of discuss too much a book that's very, very visual.
It's massively visual.
Some of the designs in here are just phenomenal. And there's, I mean, I'm just picking, just flicking and picking pages. I'm on page 51, and it's a picture of some of the people on Kijimi, and there's a little BB-8 style droid with a very unusual shaped head. The way that they can just go off and riff on what's come before to bring you new things.
Yeah, you're talking about you've got the droid who's got kind of the same shaped head as the hat the person's wearing, but then that kind of like cloak or that coat is very much kind of like, yeah, like as you say, it's a riff off of BB-8, that kind of design, that orange design he's got on his body. I really like some of the iterations of Zori, I think. And it looks, at least it looks like from this book, that they had an idea about what they were going to want her to look like.
Oh, totally, with the long head and everything, yeah.
They do, I mean, they do say that actually a lot of the helmet designs have these kind of what they call ears, but basically JJ kept on knocking them off from the maquettes, so they're just like, sod it, let's just remove it. Which is a funny, happy accident, I guess, of JJ's kind of like clumsiness, I guess. But yeah, I mean, you don't really kind of get a huge amount from what I've read so far, and I'm pretty much only about up to about page 70, and I'm trying to read this all the way through.
Yeah,
you know, they talk about at one point the people of Kijimi that or Zori's gangsters, the head of that gang was going to be, I guess, a digital or some kind of monster type creature.
Yeah,
made Zori the head of a gang, and then they moved it from, I think, the desert planet to the snow planet of Kijimi. So therefore, they had to go back, obviously redefine what they're wearing, because obviously you don't wear the same thing in desert as you do in snow and stuff like that. So it kind of gives you an idea of like the iterations, but
that's exactly the word I was just going to say, because you know the design teams were working on obviously like earlier script later in the book. Just again, I'm still skimming it as I sort of build up the review, but they say that JJ and Chris Terrio had only been working on it for sort of a matter of a few weeks when a lot of these designs were being done. So they're working off earlier versions of different scripts. I mean, Trevorrow's mentioned in here a couple of times. It's quite striking to see how, I'd love to know to more degree when they eventually get to a making of the Rise of Skywalker book, as opposed to an art of, what the overlap was, what the bleed over was, how much stuff kind of made it from one era of the film, if that makes sense, to the next.
Yeah, well, this is it. I mean, it would be interesting, and I don't know what language the previously leaked book, I think it was South Korean, so I don't know if that was actually released in Korean or if that was in English, but it'd be interesting to see what the big differences was, or the reason why they felt they needed to kind of hold back this release and actually see if it's like, if it's just maybe just as they kind of reported that JJ had, he couldn't remember, you know, doing the interview, and basically everything is as the same, or whether or not it actually had more stuff in it that maybe referred back to the Colin Trevorrow kind of aspects. Because I mean, just flicking through again, as you said, and this is our justification for not really understanding or knowing the book very well.
Sure.
There is that lovely, gorgeous double page spread of the lake creature, which is something that is in the expanded edition novel by Ray Carson. And also, again, it's something that's kind of been mentioned in the quite heavily in the Colin Trevorrow kind of novel. There was this creature that Vader learned from. And so it kind of like, again, was that something, that's where that kind of concept started with. And then obviously, as they moved into handing it over to JJ and Chris Terrio, that's where they then started changing stuff. Because I think also, I guess sometimes, I guess you could pretty much tell how close some of the designs are to what you see in the actual film.
Yeah, yeah.
Like Janna, for instance, there's a few designs, but they're fairly kind of like close to what you do end up seeing. So it's, are these later kind of drawings, or is this something that they roughly knew where they wanted this, you know, how this character to look?
Yeah. There's what I'm saying, on page 161, there's a picture of the Falcon skimming, sort of, they describe it the rings of Saturn, and it's got the triangular dish. Now, about, oh, blimey, 6, 7, 8 months ago on Fantha, we posted a piece that said, obviously, in Force Awakens, you have the rectangular dish. In, you know, and again in Last Jedi, which it got destroyed and knocked off, and then was without a dish, and then now you have the classic sort of circular dish back on the Falcon in the film, slightly tweaked. But in between, there was a triangular dish, and we had a post on Fantha, like an artist's rendition. I think Dave Tree did it, like an artist's rendition of the Falcon with the triangular dish, and not much got said about it. And very satisfied to see that one. There were early versions of a Mattel vehicle of the Falcon with the triangular dish. And now on page 161, there's actually a pre-production picture of the Falcon with exactly the same dish. So nice to know that Dave was on the ball with that one and that we were quite correct.
to show it. That was quite cool to see. And also it was really cool actually seeing that that Hot Toys, Hot Wheels, sorry. It was really cool to see that Hot Toys figure actually get kind of... images from that get released, because like I said, it kind of ties everything together really nicely.
It's a beautiful book. It's worth waiting for, wasn't it?
I think so. I mean, it's definitely all these kind of art of books from Force Awakens and Last Jedi are great, and they really show, I think, the level of effort and just absolute amazing kind of artistic integrity that goes into drawing these stuff. I mean, there's just a page, I think it's 122, and it's just like, there's just like all these different, slight different iterations of Dio. And it's clear that they've obviously, if they wanted to go with some kind of unibody type shape from the beginning, it's just kind of like little stuff, like, you know, the detailing on the head. And these are all kind of like pencil sketches. It's not like a big art, you know, big kind of like full kind of like colour thing, but it's like, it's a case study to show these are the iterations that they went through or possibilities. I find this stuff fascinating. It was great. So I'm glad it's here.
Absolutely. Same here. And keep your eyes peeled to Fantha Tracks. We will have a full review of the book, and we'll make sure there's some lovely images in there as well, so you can have a little mooch and then go out and buy it, because I think everybody should own this one. Okay, that's it for this episode of Making Tracks, episode 31. Thanks for listening, and if you want to stay part of the action and updated on all the latest Star Wars news, check out Fantha Tracks app via the App Store on your mobile device. You can reach us via email at radio@fanthatracks.com. You can comment, like and share on any of our social media feeds at Fantha Tracks, and make sure to subscribe and leave a review, as long as it's a good one, 5 stars preferably, on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or your podcaster or smart speaker of choice. Thank you always, Mark. Have a good week.
You too, my friend. Enjoy your Easter eggs.
Brilliant. Have a good week, and we'll catch you next week.
Take care.